happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. I'd like to welcome everyone around the world listening right now on all the syndicated stations. If you realize, we're in over 170 countries, so we take seriously the issues that you find important, and I appreciate all the emails because it lets us know what you're doing. Everyone's interested in living a longer, happier, healthier life, and that's why the largest single segment of our program each day deals with that. But right behind that's the environment. So we're going to do a special report today, Fear of a Living Planet, Charles Eisenstein from Cosmos Journal. I'll also be sharing today the idea that moderate, just a small amount of alcohol, good for you, good for your heart, good for your brain. No. No. University of California, San Francisco, is talking about how even moderate, small amounts of alcohol are bad. I'll explain what it does to you. And the question is then, why were you telling people otherwise? And I have a commentary on that. Also today, the Mediterranean diet could lower the risk of cardiovascular disease, University of Cambridge, and how acupuncture reduces hot flashes for half of women, Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center, and also how enhanced curcumin boosts endothelial function for healthy people, Texas Christian University. What's that mean? Enhanced curcumin. I'll explain it. How it's going to allow you to live a longer life. And a new study finds that yoga breathing lowers inflammation, from Psychology Today. Also today, we're going to look at how America's most prosperous companies get $2 million per job subsidy at their data centers. That's a huge amount of money. We're talking about billions of dollars of public support for just 11 new data centers. Now that I did some research, how much money do you think these people made in pre-tax profits? $120 billion they made in profits. And yet, we the people are giving them $2 billion in public support. Why? I'll explain that. And also, for those of you who believe in a truly progressive healthcare system, I'll explain that in detail, how we can get it, how we can afford it. I've done the numbers, and they work, with no new taxes on us, where every person is covered no matter what medical issue they have. Nobody would be denied it. Then why is it that Hillary Clinton out there campaigning, especially to women and minorities, are talking about their health issues and how she would help them? Okay, that would be good if it would be true. Unfortunately, it isn't. How do we know? Because WikiLeaks released one of John Podesta's November emails talking about what Hillary really believes in. And she is completely against single-payer bailout measure, the actual wording in the email. Well, so what we have is we have what she is saying, and we have what she is actually doing behind the scenes. That's good. But, oh, wait, in one of her emails, she said you had to have two issues, a public one, then your private one. The one you're going to act on is your private one. The people you're going to honor are the backdoor deals, with Goldman Sachs, Big Pharma, Big Nuclear, Big War Machine. What about all those public statements? Well, that's to encourage people to believe in her. The other day, I'd begin my day very early, and I work out in the park and then work out in the gym. And then there's a period of time where I do my writing and try to write commentaries and look at the issues that we face. And I have the radio in the background, and on a particular station, I hear that there's going to be a guest really encouraging us to believe in the importance of the white helmets. So I listened. I didn't hear any criticism of the white helmets. But just the same week, a week ago, on Tuesday evening, on the Progressive Commentary Hour, I had a woman on who is an award-winning journalist, an activist, a feminist, who had spent months in Syria, including getting into Aleppo and other places that other journalists have not been. And she spoke with hundreds of Syrians at all levels of the society. Boy, did she have a different take on the white helmets. In the daytime, they will help people. At nighttime, they're terrorists. And she gave details and examples with photographs of people with white helmets and the same person standing on the body of someone who had been killed. If we can find this information, if we can find these people who are not aligned to any ideology, why can't other radio hosts who have $10 and $15 million a year budgets, why can't they find this? We'll discuss that. We have a lot to share. Plus, the real reason Gaddafi was killed by Hillary Clinton and Obama. Everything else you've heard from the New York Times are lies. And then recently there was, and this was actually embarrassing to hear Geraldo talk about how, give me a single example, one single example of pay to play. And he was challenging Bill O'Reilly. O'Reilly, he frequently does the same thing, had no specifics. Geraldo, ask me. In fact, the last time you and I spoke was when I was on your program in a debate, and I've been on this show several times debating. So today, I'll share a very specific, absolutely detailed account of how someone who paid the Clintons and the Clinton Foundation ended up with a play, a position. Now, I'm not the one going to tell you this. ABC Network's going to tell you. So that's today. And since we haven't heard Jill Stein on any national forum talking about how she would look at foreign policy, today we're going to have her foreign policy on this. So you see, we have a really packed show. Let's begin by something that I wanted to experience. About 30 years ago, a series of articles came out suggesting that if we had alcohol, first it was one glass a day, then later it evolved into two glasses of alcohol a day, we would help our hearts, we would be healthier. I was sitting across from a gentleman I was counseling in my office, and he had serious health issues, especially heart health issues. He was on about seven different medications, including statins. When I was going through his diet, he said, but I have a healthy diet. My doctor put me on a healthy diet. And I listened to what he had to say, and we wrote out everything he was eating all day and drinking all day. And it was not a terrible diet, but it certainly wasn't anything even close to a really healthy diet. But what surprised me was that he was drinking two glasses of bourbon a day. I believe it's around 80% alcohol, at his doctor's suggestion. He also had cardiomyopathy, and one of the side effects of alcohol in the system is a weakened, flabby, really non-functioning heart. Cardiomyopathy is that. So I said, alcohol in any amount will kill cells. and so you don't want it. And even if you had low alcohol, it could disrupt the membrane, the mucous membrane near your esophagus, leading to esophageal inflammation and possibly cancer. But it could also lead to gastric distress because you have alcohol mixing with hydrochloric acid and you get a hyperacidic reaction, in which case the body starts to produce excessive mucosa to buffer this acid in your stomach. And then you don't get good digestion. It spills all that into your intestine, only partially absorbed after that because you haven't broken it down. You only have partial digestion. Remember, when food enters the stomach, it enters it at what we call bolus, B-O-L-U-S. But it should be broken down by the enzymes, the lipase to break down fat and the peptase and the different enzymes that will break it down to where it's like a thick soup. An ideal digestion, when it exits the stomach, it should be almost like a milkshake consistency. Then the body's tiny little millions of little hair-like follicles that are in the intestine, the jejunum, and other parts, absorb these molecules and take them through the system, take them through the liver where they're metabolized, and then to the cell where they can be used. That's ideally. Now, in other countries, we see that they have better digestion because they don't rush a meal. They take their time. They masticate their food. They chew. They're not consuming a lot of cold beverages with a meal. And we in America, we take two bites and swallow it down with a cola or a beverage. It's a complete problem. So when we got the person off all alcohol completely and instead substituted green tea with high polyphenol healing content, within about 3 months, he no longer had any problems with his heart. Doctor was able to take him off his meds, and he regained health. That led me to questioning everything in the scientific literature. So over a period of 3 weeks, I collected every single article on alcohol, even in small, moderate amounts, being good for you. And I said, how did all of American medicine, all of American science, and all of public health, all of it, get it wrong with this herd mentality? So I went over to Italy and France, because that's where the French paradox occurred. The paradox is that they're eating foods high in fats, which should elevate their risk of cardiovascular disease, triglycerides, cholesterol, but they actually have less heart disease, stronger hearts, less heart attacks and stroke. And the initial findings were that it was the wine they were drinking, and of course we know wine has a small but an effective amount of nutrients, mainly the polyphenols, and specifically resveratrol, but not in high quantities. You're talking about 3 to 5 milligrams. But what they weren't doing, they weren't going into the people's homes. I did. All over the place. A friend of mine owned a home, and he was over there, and I said, I don't want to, have a problem when I'm doing my research. Since I don't know the language nor the people, would you go around to your neighborhood, the people you know? Yeah. So every day we would go from early till late, till nearly dusk, talking with people. I never saw one example of people eating more than what their body would require. They generally had smaller portions. And almost every single instance, they had fruit at the end of the meal. And they always had on their table, always, grapes. And when they did bottle their own wine, I never will forget this one gentleman. He had a very small home, but he had a vineyard behind the home, as most people do. Grew all of his own produce organically. They're very into organic growing and fresh. They exchange produce a lot. In fact, it was very informal. Like the guy would grow all types of lettuces, about 20 different types of lettuces, in abundance. And then he would share the lettuce with people who grew things he didn't, string beans and beets, kales. So they had this informal way of bartering, exchange, fair exchange. But in his cellar was what really blew me away. He had 12,000 bottles of wine from grapes that were organically grown, naturally fermented. there was no sulfate added, which is a big allergen. When people don't realize when they're drinking wine, is it sulfate free? If it's not, then you can end up with allergic reaction, especially people who have any kind of bronchospasm problems or congestive lung problems or asthma. And sure enough, when you ask them the pace of their day, they don't rush. They take their time. Now, this is the entire Western Mediterranean. I found the same phenomena that I found in France and Italy and in Spain. It's all over Greece, Portugal, same way. Here in the United States, we're not eating organic. We're not taking our time. We're rushing. And then we go drink alcohol, assuming that's doing us good. It isn't. So they misconstrued the science. That was not the first time they did this. When I started seeing around 1972, a lot of people talk about the importance of fiber in the diet. And you saw all of these drinks come out, fiber drinks. It wasn't the fiber that was the important issue. It was roughage. So I had to go back to England, and I spoke with three people. The man who made this whole statement, which was John Yutkin, the first professor of nutrition at any university in Europe, and a Dr. Cleave, who had been in a Navy aboard a ship that would get fresh produce when it landed in the tropics. And he said until they landed, for about 2 weeks before they landed, men suffered from a lot of irritable bowel problems and constipation, upset stomach and bloating. But about 2 days after they were there and had all this fresh fruits and juices, everything cleared up. And the two of them working opposite each other, they didn't know each other, but they both came to the phenomena that it was the roughage. And then the final person in this, who I also interviewed, was Dr. Burkitt, Dennis Burkitt, of Burkitt's lymphoma discovery. Now, he had been the attending physician at nearly 67 East African hospitals, and he said in that entire time he was there, for years, he never saw a single case of appendicitis, colorectal cancer, or heart attack. He said it was so rare when a person in East Africa, eating the native diet, had a heart attack that people would come to see this phenomenon, doctors would. And what did he ascribe it to? Regular activity, meaning walking, and high roughage, because they ate like millet or tubers, root vegetables. They ate the whole food. So they all three started publishing about the importance of roughage. That meant more whole grains, whole foods, leaving the skin on apples, and we didn't do it. Instead, we synthesized it down to a product that could be commercialized. Fiber. So you didn't have to change from eating white bread or white sugar or drinking alcohol. All you had to do is take a teaspoon of fiber. And this fiber had no nutrients. It was just pushing the impacted fecal matter out, whereas the whole roughage diet had probiotics, reestablishing healthy bacteria in the intestine and allowing for quicker digestion from a variety of sources, and better nutrient assimilation, and a vegan plant-based diet, unless there was a culture where occasionally they might have some animal protein, but generally they didn't. So, here is the latest, University of California, on this. Quote, enjoy a glass of wine with dinner or a nightcap before bed, but don't count upon their health benefits. A new study by University of San Francisco researchers found that even modern alcohol consumption may change the structure of the heart in ways that increase the risk of AFib, atrial fibrillation. Quote, there's growing evidence that moderate alcohol intake may be a risk factor for AFib, the most common heart rhythm disturbance in the world. But the mechanisms by which alcohol may lead to AFib is unknown. But it does, and that's according to Dr. Gregory Marcus, endowed professor of AFib research at the university. And this was published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. Then they talk about the possible pathway between alcohol and AFib, and then showed how quote, looking at damage to the left atrium of the heart as a possible pathway between alcohol and AFib. AFib is a known risk factor for stroke. The irregular pumping of blood can lead to blood clots, which may travel to the brain and cause stroke. And they looked at 5,000 adults from the Framingham Heart Study and people with echocardiograms, medical history, and they found that there is definitely a link. So here's what you got to know. When you drink alcohol, any alcohol in any amount, you put yourself at risk of AFib, and that puts you at risk of a stroke or heart attack. Science, medicine, public health, the media, they were all wrong. All of them were wrong. But that's not the first thing I can tell you they've been wrong about. But it is something we can deal with. Now, from Cambridge University comes this. Eating a Mediterranean diet, that's what we advocate. You can eat it as a vegan, which would be ideal, or you can eat it with a fish, occasional fish, which would be second to ideal. And both are going to benefit you. But according to the British Medical Journal, you could, quote, lower your risk of developing heart disease and stroke by using this diet. And they looked at every possible angle, and I've seen over 1,500 studies on the Mediterranean diet. So it's no longer, does it extend life? Yes. Will it prevent cancer, heart disease, stroke? Yes. Will it help you maintain control over your weight? Yes. Does it provide nutrients, allow you to live longer life by helping your epithelium? Yes. So the science is 100% on the side of this diet, but then you still have to deal with the conditioned response of people not wanting to change. Quote, the Mediterranean diet provided a 16% lower risk of future cardiovascular disease compared to individuals who did not adhere to it. Quote, the Mediterranean diet is typically high in fruits, good, vegetables, good, whole grains, good, nuts, good, olive oil, good, and much lower in dairy, poultry, and wine. So, you've been on the right side of that for as long as you've been listening to this radio program. And finally, from Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center, acupuncture reduces hot flashes for 50% of women. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Menopause, and scientists reported that about 50% of the women in the study reduced frequent hot flashes and when they did acupuncture. So acupuncture for hot flashes. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. You got a smile so bright. You know you could have been a candle. I'm holding you so tight. You know you could have been a handle. The way you swept me off the field. I'd like to welcome you. I'm Gary Noll. If you're one of watching this program, just go to Ustream channel and search for Gary Noll. We're going to give you now the real story of why Colonel Gaddafi was destroyed, his country was obliterated, and now it's a hotbed for extremist activity. Who benefited from this, and why did they do it? And you're going to hear that, but I just want to mention that we have even more people now listening live to this program Monday to Friday, noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time, Tuesday evening, 7 to 9, because now from 7 to 8 is our progressive commentary hour, always a very serious issue. And then 8 to 9 is the new talkback. No guests, no commentary, just a whole hour devoted to your response, your questions, your issues. You can listen anywhere in North America. And I'm not saying United States and Canada because we're really talking about one continent in Canada and the United States. Here's the telephone number to have. 515-605-9429. 515-605-9429. But let's say you can't listen live, but you're out and about. And especially younger people, they want to listen on their portable devices, you can. Any portable device, you can go to a telephone and listen to any archival show. Something kind of amusing to me. I'm in Denver, and I go up early in the morning. I just premiered not one, not two, but three programs on PBS Denver just about, I think it was 4 weeks ago now, on a Saturday night. And the next morning, I had to get back, so I went out very early, and no one's in line. I'm just the only one there, and this guy is not calling me yet. So finally, I walk over the counter after 5 minutes. I said, I just want to make sure I'm not going to miss my flight. And he looks up. He says, not a problem. And I hand him my ticket. He said, I'm listening to you right now. I said, you are? He's, yeah. He's listening to PRN from the archives. I just thought it was kind of interesting. You never know. You can listen at any time to any of the shows. Let me give you the archival number. This way you call it, download the archive. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. And if you don't think a lot of people are listening, the numbers that Jesse gave us last week for one show, more people downloaded a show, one single show, than the entire 24/7 grid for one of our sister stations on Pacifica. In fact, if you took two stations, put all their audience together, more people listened to one show. So the people are getting the information. I just want everyone to have it. Now, let's listen to the real reasons why Colonel Gaddafi was killed and Libya was invaded.
Well, more speculation has been raised on the reasons for NATO's intervention in Libya. And as RT's Laura Emmett reports, the organization may have been trying to prevent Gaddafi from burying the American buck.
According to some, it's about protecting civilians.
We must not tolerate this regime using military force against its own people.
Others say it's about oil.
The only reason they're interested with Libya is about the oil. You'd think we'd be in Iraq if the major export there was broccoli.
But some are convinced intervention in Libya is all about currency, specifically Gaddafi's plan to introduce the gold dinar, a single African currency made from gold, a true sharing of the wealth.
It's one of these things that you have to plan almost in secret, because as soon as you say you're going to change over from the dollar to the something else, you're going to be targeted. There were two conferences on this, one in 96 and another one in the year 2000, called the World Mataba Conference, organized by Gaddafi. And everybody was interested. I think most countries in Africa were keen.
Gaddafi didn't give up. In the months leading up to the military intervention, he called on African and Muslim nations to join together to create this new currency that would rival the dollar and euro. They would sell oil and other resources around the world only for gold dinars. It's an idea that would shift the economic balance of the world. Countries' wealth would depend on how much gold they have, not how many dollars they trade. And Libya has 144 tons of gold. The UK has double that, but 10 times the population.
If Gaddafi had an intent to try to reprice his oil or whatever else the country was selling in the global markets and accept something else as a currency, or maybe launch a gold dinar currency, any move such as that would certainly not be welcomed by the power elite today, who are responsible for controlling the world's central banks. So yes, that would certainly be something that would cause his immediate dismissal and the need for other reasons to be brought forth for removing him from power.
It's happened before. In 2000, Saddam Hussein announced Iraqi oil would be traded in euros, not dollars. Sanctions and an invasion followed. Some say because the Americans were desperate to prevent OPEC from transferring oil trading in all its member countries to the euro.
The UK's gold is kept here in a secure vault somewhere in the depths of the Bank of England. As in most developed countries, there's not enough to go around. But that's not the case in places like Libya and many of the Gulf states. A gold dinar would have given oil-rich African and Middle Eastern countries the power to turn around to their energy-hungry customers and say, sorry, the price has gone up and we want gold. Some say the US and its NATO allies literally couldn't afford to let that happen.
Laura Emmett, RT, London.
Now, how do we know that that's accurate and objective? WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks found emails proving this between Hillary Clinton personally and one of her close friends, who was also an outside advisor on foreign affairs. The trouble is the way that we approach foreign affairs is with dominance and with our hegemonic mindset. Let's hear what Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, has to say about her aptitude on foreign policy.
Dr. Stein, you said that you oppose the use of U.S. forces overseas. U.S. forces are currently engaged in airstrikes against ISIS and other military operations. My question is, do you consider ISIS to be a threat to the U.S. or to U.S. allies and partners in the Middle East? And if so, what would you do to defeat ISIS that the Obama administration is not currently doing?
So, you know, there are rules of engagement, international rules, that if you're going to attack another country, you need to be at imminent threat of being actually attacked by them. Clearly, that threshold has not been met. ISIS is not about to launch a major attack against our country. And we have a track record now of fighting terrorism, not only ISIS, but Al-Qaeda before it, the Taliban before that. And this track record is not looking so good. We have spent $6 trillion, according to a recent Harvard study, when you include the costs, the ongoing costs of health care for our wounded veterans who deserve the highest care possible. $6 trillion, which since 2001. We have killed 1 million people in Iraq alone, which is not winning us the hearts and minds in the Middle East. We have lost tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers that have been killed or severely wounded. And what do we have to show for this? Failed states, mass refugee migrations, and repeated terrorist threats that get worse with each cycle. So ISIS grew out of the catastrophe of Iraq. Al-Qaeda, in turn, grew out of Afghanistan. And in fact, in Afghanistan, it was the CIA and the Saudis together who created the first so-called jihadi movement with the Mujahideen in order to make trouble against the Soviet Union. So this has been a very ill-conceived plan that has been backfiring madly against us. So what we say is that we need a new kind of offensive in the Middle East, because bombing terrorism and shooting terrorism is not quelling terrorism, it's only fanning the flames of terrorism, the misery and the poverty that drive terrorism. We are calling for a new kind of offensive, a peace offensive in the Middle East that begins with a weapons embargo. And since we are supplying, we the U.S. is supplying the majority of the weapons to actually all combatants, we and our allies are arming most of the fighting forces in the Middle East, we can initiate that weapons embargo. And we also call for a freeze on the funding of those countries who continue to support jihadi terrorist enterprises. Hillary Clinton herself said in a leaked State Department memo that, in fact, the Saudis are still the major funder of terrorist Sunni enterprises. So if we started it, we and our allies have the capacity to shut it down. So that's how we need to move forward. So we now have somewhere between seven.
So stop selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, to Qatar, to the United Arab Emirates, to the countries, Egypt, who then use those weapons against their own civilians who are opposed to the type of dynastic rule, and then stop doing business with them, freeze their assets. After all, remember this, you've had upward to 7 million people fleeing war-torn areas, mainly Yemen, which we are now actively engaged in. Up to this point, all the weapons, the bombs, the planes, the missiles have been made in the United States, sold to Saudi Arabia or Qatar, and then used against the people seeking freedom from the Sunni rule in Yemen. And now we're actively engaged militarily. So stop. Start doing business with these people. And then ask, how many of these refugees have you taken in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait? How about none? Why isn't that being discussed? The countries that have caused the crisis by the wars that they are in, regime change they have engaged in Libya, Syria, and Yemen, why are they now not being challenged to solve it? Something for us to think about. I'm in the midst of completing a major film on the environment. Should be done within about 3 months. My newest film will be finished this week, 3 years in the making. I look forward to meeting with people in this audience at the various premieres that will be happening in the near future. But when it comes to the environment, I frequently ask people, are you pro-environment? And the vast majority say yes. Then I ask, what specifically in your life do you do that shows that you care about the environment? And then you get this kind of glazed look. Well, they might have supported the Sierra Club or Greenpeace, but no, personally, what have you done? Are you buying locally grown food, organic food? Are you using paper instead of plastic? Have you stopped consuming things you don't need? Are you joining in an effort to clean up some part? Are you joining one of the efforts to re-green the world in some way? And then you start to see the disconnect, this cognitive disconnect. By refusing to recognize that the earth is alive, we implicitly endorse the worldview that enables our destruction of the planet. And according to Charles Eisenstein, and I believe most reasoned people, does the concept of a living planet uplift and inspire you? Or is it a disturbing example of the woo-woo nonsense that distracts us from practical science-based policies? Because at this moment, we have a divide. I've mentioned this many times in this program. Part of the divide is we all see the extent to global warming. We may not see acidification of the oceans, but we hear about these great fish kills, whales starving to death, porpoises beaching themselves, the coral reef, the great coral reef, which took 35 million years to create in Australia, dead. In fact, coral reefs all over the world dying. And they've died in the last 35 years. We see in Louisiana the worst flooding in the state's history. In fact, we had 37,000 major fires in the United States in the environment in the last 12 months. Now, they may not be where you live, but they still happened. Are we connected with it? We have over 1.5 billion people insecure in the world, food insecure. But if it's not our child or we who are food deprived, do we connect with it? The fact that we may not be appreciating by personal immediate experience doesn't mean that these experiences are not happening to other people. So then we say, surely the next environmental conference will cause something. Show me the conference that we've had up to this point that has caused anything. Because the people behind the government are the corporations who do not want to spend the billions of dollars to re-engineer their firms so that they lessen or eliminate pollution. To the contrary, in New York State, Governor Cuomo just allowed $2 billion of our money to go to a nuclear facility as if that's going to help global warming. If he was educated on the matter, he would know it increases global warming and is a major, major danger to our safety. But he was given this information, so it's not out of ignorance that he made his choice. We must look for another motive. Then we have those people who believe in everything's okay. No, it's not. I really don't want to hear another person say everything's okay when it isn't. That's that woo-woo example. And then we have those environmentalists who are into one environmental action, and all they see is running around informing people of it. then you know, I have to pull back and ask myself in the most objective way possible, are any of these people making an actual difference? Set aside the publicity. Are we actually changing? And the answer is very little. There are individuals engaged in solar, but we're not subsidizing it. And until we subsidize solar and bring the price down, we're not going to have it. Think of all of California, Texas, Utah, Nevada, Florida, Oklahoma, that have high amounts of sun for most of the year, and yet we're not engaging those people. The scientifically oriented nuts and bolts environmental or social activists will roll their eyes upon hearing phrases like, the planet is a living being. Now from there, it's just a short step to sentiments like, love will heal the world, or what we need is most is a shift in consciousness. Or some will say, let's get in touch with our indigenous soul. Okay, just words. I can't tell you how many times I've gone to conferences or peace meetings and I saw a whole lot of violence, a lot of peace activists, and a lot of environmentalists who would talk about, you know, getting in touch with Mother Nature and then be eating a hamburger. What's wrong with such ideas? The skeptics make a potent argument. Not only are these ideas delusional, they say, but to voice them is a strategic error that opens environmentalism to accusations of flakiness. By invoking unscientific concepts, by prattling on about the heart or spirit or the sacred, we will be dismissed as naive, fuzzy-headed, irrational, hysterical, over-emotional hippies. What we need, they say, is more data, more logic, more numbers, better arguments, more practical solutions framed in language acceptable to policymakers and the public. Well, I've been in this movement a long time. I've never seen any of that work. Until there's a disaster, whether the disaster is cancer, heart attack, bankruptcy, divorce, then suddenly, for a moment in time, someone's willing to say, what was it you were saying? I think that argument is mistaken. By shying away from the idea of a living planet, we rob environmentalism of its authentic motive and its force, and engender paralysis rather than action, and implicitly endorse the worldview that enables our destruction of the planet. I believe in what is called the psychology of contempt. To see that, let's start by observing that the objection to the Earth is alive isn't primarily a scientific objection. After all, science can easily affirm or deny Earth's aliveness depending upon what definition of life is being used. No, we are dealing with an emotional perception here, one that goes beyond alive to affirm that Earth is a sentient, conscious, even sacred entity. That is what upsets the critics. Furthermore, the derisiveness of the criticism, encoded in words like hippie or flake or pseudoscientific or non-intellectual, that is what nails their position. Usually derision comes from insecurity or fear. Judgment, according to Marshall Rosenberg, is the tragic expression of an unmet need. So, what are all these experts, these scientists, these government officials, the media, what are they all afraid of? Could it be that the contempt comes in part from a fear that one is oneself naive, irrational, and over-emotional? Could the target of the derision be the projection of an insecurity lurking within themselves? Is there a part of ourselves that we disown and project in distorted form onto others? An innocent, trusting, childlike part? A vulnerable part? Or simply stated, what do you dislike about yourself that you're willing to project upon others? If so, then critics of the infiltration of the New Age ideas into the environmental movement may not be serving the movement at all. They may be enacting their own psychological dramas instead. If you're one of those critics, I'm not asking you to join the hands with me and sing Kumbaya. I ask only that you soberly and honestly consider where your discomfort of the truth comes from. Certainly much of the discomfort is a healthy revulsion towards the escapism, spiritual bypass, and the culture appropriation that plagues so much of the New Age movement. Certainly there is a danger that, intoxicated with the idea of cosmic purpose or some such, we ignore the pain and grief that we must integrate if we are to act effectively and courageously. Certainly dogma like, well, it's all good. Nonsense. Stop that childish gibber. It's not all good. There are serious problems, and you're delusional if you think you're somehow going to escape responsibility by saying it's all good. Or we're all one. We're not all one. And if you believe that, then you can blind us to the existence of a planetary crisis and discourage us from making changes in our own personal lives. Certainly, borrowed rituals and concepts of sacredness can be an insidious form of colonization, a strip mining of cultural treasure to compensate for and enable the continuation of our own cultural vacuity. However, such criticisms address a mere caricature of the thoughtful work of generations of philosophers and scientists and spiritual teachers who have framed sophisticated alternatives to conventional phenomenological and ontological and causal narratives. What I'm saying is not to hide behind a disjointed criticism. The fear of being emotional, irrational, hysterical is very close to a fear of the inner emptiness, the helplessness, and the exclusion of the fuzzy and ill-defined and emotionally perceived dimensions of our activism in favor of the linear, rational, evidence-based mirrors, the domination over and marginalization of the feminine from our social choice-making. Part of our resistance to the notion of Earth as a living being could be in the patriarchal mind feeling threatened by feminine ways of knowing and choosing. But that's still pretty theatrical. When I apprehend concepts as Earth is alive, or all things are sacred, or the universe and everything in it bears sentience, purpose in life, there's always an emotion involved. In no case is my rejection or acceptance the result of pure rationalization. Either I embrace them with a feeling of eager, tender hope, or I reject them with a feeling of wariness. That wariness is deeply connected to the contempt I've described. The derision of the cynic comes from a wound of crushed idealism and betrayal of hopes. We received it on a cultural level when the Age of Aquarius morphed into the Age of Ronald Reagan, and on an individual level as well when our childish perception of a living personal universe in which we are destined to grow into magnificent creatures gave way to the adulthood of deferred dreams and lowered expectations. Anything that exposes this wound will trigger our protective instincts. One such protection is cynicism, which rejects and derides as foolish, naive, or irrational anything that affirms the magic and idealism of our youth. Our perceived worldview has cut us off, often quite brutally, from the intimate connection with the rest of life and with the rest of matter. The child hugs a tree and thinks it feels the hug and imagines the tree is his friend, only to learn that, no, I'm sorry, the tree is just a bunch of wood, cells, with no central nervous system, and therefore cannot possibly have the qualities of beingness that humans have. Or at least that's what the child is told. The child imagines that just as she looks out on the world looks back at her, only to learn that, no, I'm sorry, the world consists of a jumble of insatiable stuff, a random medley of subatomic particles, and that intelligence and purpose reside only in human beings, not animals, not nature, just you. And then you're graded and deferred to based upon how much of that you have. Science, as we know it, renders us alone in an alien universe. At the same time, it crowns us as the lords and masters. For if sentience and purpose inhere in us alone, then there is nothing stopping us from engineering the world as we see it. There is no desire to listen for longer processes, to participate in no consciousness to respect. Cut down the tree, it doesn't feel anything. Kill the fish, it doesn't feel anything. Slaughter the calf, it too has no feelings. But it does. How many times have you heard, but the planet really isn't alive? That's part of the ideological cutoff. Isn't that the same cutoff that enables us to despoil the planet? The wounded child interjects. But what if it is true? What if the universe really is just a science project? What if, as the biologist Jacques Monod put it, we are alone in an alien world, a world that is deaf to man's music, just as indifferent to his hopes as to his suffering or his crimes. Such is the wail of the separate self. It is loneliness and separation disguised as empirical question. With no amount of evidence being able to prove it false, we must acknowledge that the science that militates against an intelligent, purposeful, living universe is ideological, freighted, and culturally bound. Witness the hostility of institutional science to any analogous data or unearthed theory that suggests purposelessness or intelligence is a property of innate matter. Water memory, adaptive mutation, crop circles, morphic fields, psi phenomena, yeah, plant communications, precognitive dreams in a living earth, a living sun, a living universe, all incite abject scorn. Anyone who believes in these or even takes them as a valid topic to discuss risks the usual epithets of pseudoscience, fake, woo-woo, regardless of the merits of the theory or the strength of the evidence. Our discomfort with New Age-sounding concepts like the planet is alive is not entirely rational, but comes in large part from a wound of betrayal cloaked in the pervasive ideology of our culture. Is it true, though? We might play with various definitions of life and come up with logical, evidence-based arguments, pro and con, just as we could debate the veracity of an anomalous data and unconventional theories, and never come to its agreement. Let me just take a moment to look at the matter through a strategic lens instead. What belief motives effective action and change? Most people listen to this program probably consider themselves to be environmentalist. Certainly most people think it is important to create a society that leaves a livable planet to future generations. What is it exactly that makes us into environmentalist? If we answer that, we might now know in turn that environmentalism is a way of having a deeper, more intimate commitment to the planet we live on, I would agree. I don't know about you, but I didn't become an environmentalist because someone made a rational argument that convinced me that the planet was in danger. I became an environmentalist out of love and pain, love for the world and its beauties and its mysteries, and the grief of seeing it destroyed. It was only because I was in touch with these feelings that I had the ears to listen to evidence and reason, and the eyes to see what is happening to the world. I believe that this love and this grief are latent in every human being. When they weaken, we do nothing. When they awaken, you become an environmentalist. Now, I'm not saying that a rational, evidence-based analysis of the situation and possible solutions is unimportant. It is. But we should not wait for it. We should not wait for this. Reality always supersedes scientific discovery, and that has to wait a long time for corporate and political acceptance. The most potent form of ideological insulation, though, is the belief that the world is simply in pain and that nothing worse is happening than the manipulation of matter by machines. And that therefore, as long as we can engineer some substitute for ecosystem services, there need to be no limit to what we do to nature. Absent any inherent purpose or intelligence, the planet is here for us to use, abuse, take, and exploit. Just look around the planet. See the results of that kind of ideological writ large. These people do not love life with the planet included, only the material gain and profit. The idea that our planet is alive, and further, that every mountain, every river, lake, and forest is a living being, even a sentient, purpose, sacred being, is therefore not a soppy emotional distraction from the environmental problems at hand. It is the contrary. It disposes us to feel more, to care more, and to do more. No longer can we hide from our grief and love behind the ideology that the world is just a pile of stuff to be used instrumentally for our own ends. True, the ideology is perfectly consistent with cutting carbon emissions and consistent as well with any environmental argument that invokes our survival as the primary basis of policymaking. A lot of environmental activism depends on appeal to survival anxiety. We no longer change our ways or else. Appealing to fear and selfish interest in general is a natural tactic for anyone coming from a belief that the planet has no intrinsic value, no value beyond its utility. Whatever the reason is preserved, it is there when it has no intrinsic value. But in conclusion, it should be no surprise that this tactic has failed. When environmentalists cite the potential economic losses from climate change, they implicitly endorse economic gain and loss as a basis for environmental decision-making. Doubtless, they are imagining that they must speak the language of power and the elites, who supposedly don't understand anything but money. But this strategy backfires when, as is the norm, financial self-interest and ecological sustainability are opposed. Similarly, calls to preserve the rainforest because of the value of the medicine that may one day be derived from its species imply that if only we can invent synthetic alternatives to whatever the forest might bear, we need preserve the rainforest after all. Even appealing to the well-being of one's grandchildren harbors a similar trap. If that is your first concern, then what about the environmental issues that only affect people in faraway lands or that don't tangentially harm any human being at all? The clubbing of baby seals, the extinction of the river dolphin, the deafening of whales with sonar. It is hard to construct a compelling argument that any of these threaten the measures of well-being of future generations. Are we then to sacrifice these beings for a little utility? I think not. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day. He came.